Welcome to The Gauge, a new podcast brought to you by Greengage, the first fully integrated financial services group, bridging the traditional financial services space with the new digital innovations in crypto assets and blockchain. In this series, we gauge expert opinion on the latest tech trends and plan to bring you a measured approach to discussing key developments in the world of blockchain and digital assets. Your host today is Greengage CEO Sean Kiernan, who's in conversation with Tina Baker-Taylor, Vice President, Policy and Regulatory Strategy in the UK and EU at Circle. In this episode, Sean and Tina discuss her thoughts around DeFi, CeFi, and TradFi, and what roles each should play in the ecosystem. They look at the place of regulation in progressing the above developments and its impact on innovation, and discuss developments in governance in the crypto asset market. And last but not least, they look at what the UK can do better when it comes to building the right conditions for the crypto asset industry to flourish.
Tina, delighted to have you with us. I think you and I have been on a few panels together now. To have you on The Gauge is a real treat. You have a very clear voice in the crypto sector, and I think one of the things that would be of interest for me is just to hear a bit of your background. If you could just do a quick whistle-stop tour of who you are, what you do.
Sure. Well, Sean, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to join you today, and I always enjoy our chats. I'm looking forward to this. So I have been in the digital asset space full-time for probably about 5 or 6 years. I used to be involved in evaluating DLT and kind of fintech opportunities within a large investment bank. And during that process, looking into blockchain technology, I became very interested in what I saw as really the only kind of use case that was out in the wild, and that was really crypto and digital assets. And so moved into this part of the industry full time, really focused on a couple of areas. One, commercial development, two, communications marketing, and three, really, as initially a bit of a byproduct, the policy and regulatory space. And over the years, it will be no surprise to anyone listening, the policy and regulatory discussions have become critically important. And so they started to take significantly more of my time. And now I work on policy full-time as Circle's Vice President for Policy and Regulatory Strategy for Europe and the UK.
Quite a big role. Circle's one of the bigger names in our space. It'd be great to hear a little bit about what you do, but maybe first a broader question. We've been hearing a lot about crypto in the press. I think the blow up of FTX is going to be something that lives with us for a while. And one of the discussions I know you and I have had, and I think is one that a lot of us are talking about, is what is the role of the traditional finance space, what's been emerging in the crypto space, or what we call the DeFi or CeFi, centralized finance or decentralized finance. And as you say, you're excited about blockchain and the technology itself. It'd be great to hear your perspective on how you hear that story unfolding, how traditional finance will work with these new technologies.
Sure. I think if you look at the original genesis of crypto assets in their nascent form, some of the early ideas were that they would be disruptive, that would potentially replace how we transact with each other. They would replace different types of products and services that are offered today through traditional finance. And I think what we're really seeing now is a convergence and a bridge between traditional finance and this emerging area of decentralized finance. And I think that's healthy and there's a balance. I think I believe there will always be a need for traditional financial institutions. I think it's possible as we look toward the future that, you know, some of the early use cases for DeFi that we see today around lending and staking investments could potentially evolve into things like underwriting mortgages and debt and maybe equity in companies, the same way that kind of tokens offer that today. However, having said that, I think that what we're seeing now, certainly over the last 6 months, is a real spotlight being shown on without some clear governance guidelines. And those could be sound corporate governance, they could be regulatory governance, supervision, they could be just what does it take to operate a company that handles people's money, whether it be digital or traditional in its approach, what does good look like? And I think that a number of the failures that we've seen over the past 6 months have really highlighted the need to establish what those good business practices look like.
It's really interesting to frame it in terms of what does good look like, which is almost independent of regulation. This is how do you run a business properly? What role do you think regulation is playing or will play in that era of convergence that you've outlined between traditional and these new digital technologies coming together?
I think it's two sides of a similar coin, really. And what I think is interesting is when things go wrong, you know, I've seen some people that have been in this space for a really long time, as things collapse, say, where is the insert whatever agency you want, the FCA, the SEC, where were they in all of this? And then if you back up a few years, it was, this is not something that we necessarily need to regulate. This is a completely new area of finance. And then somewhere in the middle, there are the advocates like me that think that we should potentially put rules around the activities, not necessarily the market actors themselves as a cohort, right? I think regulating, quote, crypto, because it's crypto, doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. Regulating the activities makes more sense. And some of those market actors that conduct activities like digital asset marketplaces, trading venues, we have similar type of actors and other types of finance where we can pull from what good looks like. But regulation isn't a catch-all for everything. And there's a distinction between having a rule, being able to comply with the rule, and then being able to adequately supervise that rule, right? And so if all of those things aren't there, then the rules aren't going to be effective and you're not going to reach ultimately the governance objective that you're looking for. And then I think within that, you can almost look at this into the buckets that I described earlier. There's AML and CTF obligations to prevent money laundering and human trafficking and bad things in the world. But being able to comply with those AML CTF obligations doesn't necessarily mean that you're practicing good, sound fiduciary governance, that you have a solid board that's providing you with advice and advisory services to help you grow in a sustainable way, that you have the right kind of hearts and minds within your team that are looking at what's important for today, and again, how to scale that business in a way that is both responsible and sustainable. And so those are things that regulation in and of itself won't be able to solve, right? And so that's what I mean about what good looks like. And I think the other piece to that is just because there is regulatory guidance that doesn't necessarily always give you a roadmap for exactly how you're supposed to do something. And I think if we look across jurisdictions, we've seen guidance being given that in some cases is a little bit more descriptive than others, but it doesn't necessarily tell you what good looks like. And it might be a cut and paste of an existing kind of regulatory framework that doesn't take into account the nuances that come with this type of decentralized finance. So I think it's still a bit of a mixed bag.
I think it's one of the biggest questions for our industry overall. I mean, it's quite a difficult one to answer, and I wouldn't put you on the spot to say what is the ideal form of regulation. I think it is something when we look at treating customers fairly, also thinking through what are the right things to do for a customer. And I know lots of firms in our space are very keen to do that, but not necessarily having the background in traditional finance might have brains wired a certain way where they don't necessarily think of certain outcomes. When we think of the promise of the underlying technology, which is amoral effectively, it's blockchain, it is neither good nor bad in itself. Do you think there's a way for DeFi or for the technology itself to have some kind of code or structure that can self-regulate? Or do you think there would need to be in a proper kind of three lines of defense model actors that are independent to the technology itself? If that's something you feel comfortable answering.
Yeah, I don't know that I have a complete and holistic answer to that, but I can tell you some of the things that I think about and discuss with policymakers when we're thinking specifically about DeFi. I think the first thing to say is most policymakers around the world appreciate and understand that this particular area of digital assets is really new, very, very nascent. And they don't believe yet that they fully understand both the opportunities and the risks to create regulatory guidance for DeFi. And so that kind of leaves us in a bit of a spot around, well, what if firms, do they keep building these things and wait for the other shoe to drop? Or does everybody just hold fire and try and advocate for something that's a little bit more practical and tactical? But I actually think it's a good thing, right? I think that regulating too soon often can truly inhibit innovation, and we don't want that. I do think that there are areas, and we've seen this specifically in AML discussions years ago when we were negotiating with entities like FATF around how we could use the technology to solve the policy objectives that policymakers were looking to achieve without necessarily providing cut and paste conduct measures on firms. And I think that's the critical rub with DeFi. I think most policymakers would agree that regulating code is not within their purview. And I think that most DeFi users that are using true DeFi have to accumulate a skill level today. It's not super easy to use, right? To be able to undertake the activities that they do. And I actually still think it's quite a small cohort of people that are using kind of true real DeFi, right? So the risk is low. And so what I think we could be better about, similar to the contrast with the AML discussions, is actually developing technological solutions that solve for those regulatory or policy concerns. We talk about, oh, we could do this better. The technology allows us to X. But then those kind of compliance things aren't super sexy to go and build. And so they tend to be, you know, the solutions that get built last, right? And I think you could see that through some of the travel rule compliance solutions that are in place today. They're very effective, but it was slow going to get those in place. And so I think that when you look at the true risk to consumers or to markets, indeed, is having some of those treating customer fairly elements within them, disclosures, you know, could you program that into these platforms, real information around liquidity and volumes that can't be manipulated, really being able to demonstrate code review so that things like backdoors and scams and the ability to proliferate smart contracts in a way that can be quite predatory. I think there's a number of things that we could do as an industry to kind of reduce that risk. And I think probably now is the time within any bear market. We've always seen this as a quiet period where the industry goes away and starts to think about solving some of the tough challenges. And I'd love to see that be an outcome of this one.
I think that was quite a holistic answer and a very good one. I'm very interested in actually the things that aren't necessarily rocket science just being thought through. And I think AML CTF, for example, as long as we know with whom we're dealing, and DeFi can provide such things if we have digital identity or financial passport type considerations with maybe zero knowledge proofs or something to give that flexibility around protecting your identity.
That's a great example of what I'm talking about, Sean. Say, oh, well, these zero knowledge proofs could provide that and digital identity could solve a lot of these problems. But yet there's not a lot of progress necessarily being made on tangible, practical solutions that utilize those methodologies, right? And I think that it's hard. I mean, digital identity is something that we've been talking about long before crypto, and it's hard.
It's hard.
Yeah. I do think that a great solution for being able to, in essence, tokenize me and be able to continually update that so that every time the TINA token is accessed and validated, that information is current. I think one of the things that we don't think about is KYC'd by your bank, whatever, 15 years ago when you open your account, and then they don't really ever do it again. You might get a mortgage and they might ask for some additional information, but for the most part, that information on me is quite dated with my bank. And so if that token of you could be updated continually with, have you been arrested? You know, have you been bankrupt or whatever some of these credit mechanisms or measures are, and then permissionable, right? So I might want to give you my health data and I might want to give you my financial data, but I don't want to share all of my data with everyone. And so that kind of sovereignty around how your identity is used, I think could be a critical game changer.
I mean, it's a fascinating space. And we've seen the likes of us all having credit scores and the data that's held on us, but we don't really know all the time the level of that being maintained at quite a rapid rate. We have digital identities in terms of driver's licenses or passports. But every institution is doing their own KYC AML on a standalone basis. We're not aggregating that. And I agree, it's something that unfortunately we're not seeing too much progress with outside perhaps open banking and the likes of what the UK is taking forward to think through these things, which is also being mirrored internationally. That kind of moves me to my next question, if I may, on you see policy on an international level. And a lot of us, I think, that are Gage listeners are more UK focused. It'd be great to hear what you see in Europe and the States and how the UK is faring in terms of considering these big topics. Is there anything we could do better?
Well, I think the UK has a really rich history of focusing on financial innovation. So many years ago, the UK took a very competitive stance to become really a fintech hub globally. And that was supported by a very forward-thinking regulator and indeed a smaller kind of jurisdictional approach with limited agencies involved in developing what those frameworks might look like. And so in a post-Brexit era, one would think, wow, we've got all this opportunity, right? This is what was promised to us. We're going to unbundle some of the EU regulatory obligation that might open up opportunities for the UK to be more competitive and champion growth. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that the UK is considering these things. What I think the UK could do better is actually action what they've been considering. And so we've started to see that this year, very thankfully, in the Financial Services and Markets Bill, incorporating a number of recommendations and indeed some tactical actions to bring different types of market actors and different types of crypto assets, namely stablecoins, into the regulatory perimeter. And I think that's an incredibly positive first step. I think the other thing that the UK is in a unique position to do in what I would say is a second mover position when you look across the pond to Europe is to take a look at the regulatory obligation and the methodology for overseeing crypto asset services in Europe and see if there are any kind of opportunity gaps where the UK could potentially interpret those risks and opportunities differently, which would enable firms to potentially be attracted to the UK because of some of those competitive advantages. And I think there's a number of areas where MiCA has the Markets and Crypto Assets Regulation in Europe has been incredibly or will be incredibly transformational. So it brings all 27 member states under one regime, completely limits any type of regulatory arbitrage across Europe. It's one licensing regime that's passportable. So you don't have to go country by country applying for licenses. But what it also provides is, in my view, a slightly protectionist approach, which is very Europe focused. And that's not necessarily a bad thing for Europe, but I think it doesn't also contemplate that this type of finance and these assets can move around the globe in a matter of seconds. And so it doesn't necessarily fully appreciate the one, global nature, and the two, rapid ability to transfer value in the same way that we transfer communication, for example. And so I think that the approach of looking at what MiFID covers and then solving for those gaps was smart. But in some areas, I think there's still a lot of open question in Europe around exactly how some of this stuff is going to be overseen. And so we're still looking for some clarity on a number of areas within MiCA. And then if you look across to the US, we've seen a number of proposals put forward in the form of bills. And most of them in the last half of the year were centered around stablecoin regulation again. I mean, I happen to work for one of the world's largest stablecoins, but you know, this is not me being biased. Japan is putting forward stablecoin regulation. Stablecoins are regulated within MiCA. Stablecoins are the one, you know, specifically distinct thing or crypto asset within the FSMB in the UK. And then the US has really put a lot of time and effort into looking at how we're going to regulate stablecoins. And so it begs the question, why? Where is this consistency coming from? And to me, it feels like a real reflection of kind of the AML CTF conversations that we had 3 years ago. It was one thing that all these jurisdictions could agree on was critically important to solve so that we were plugging any major risk holes. And I think that as we move toward this bridging that I talked about in the beginning, where traditional finance and DeFi are coming together, and we're starting to see a number of on and off ramps between the two environments and a number of use cases come to market that utilize both of those types of environments. So I'll give you a quick example. So today there's a partnership between the Stellar Foundation, MoneyGram, and Circle. We're not necessarily a partner, but USDC is used to transmit humanitarian aid payments as well as peer-to-peer remittances. So if I'm in Argentina and you want to send me a remittance using the Stellar network, we both have a Stellar wallet, you send me 100 USD, I can walk into a MoneyGram in Argentina and pick up $100 just like that. And it is exponentially cheaper. Something like normally 5.6%, this is somewhere around 1.7% transaction charges. And again, this is a traditional finance company, an emerging financial infrastructure company using a stable digital asset to make those transactions occur. So I think that areas where policymakers can see that bridging and that convergence is probably what's driving some of these regulatory discussions, specifically around stablecoins.
And it's a great use case. I mean, I think the moving of money very quickly, as you've outlined, is and at cost effectively, is one of the best reasons to think about using these new technologies. We saw early on, I think, off the back of Facebook's Libra project, that a lot of policymakers were aware of things, perhaps given the discussions that were happening at conferences and back at home around the opportunity that stablecoins could present, how they were constituted is quite important. One of the things that I'm curious about, and I know you're at tables and places behind the scenes that I'm not privy to necessarily, I've already clocked that I think FTX is impacting similarly these discussions happening in policy circles. And given that, I think we both agree this was a bad actor as opposed to necessarily a problem with the crypto sector in itself. This was someone who was not following the rules, good governance. Do you think this is going to have an impact as well on terms of policy development? Or do you think this is something that people can see through as an isolated case?
So the short answer is yes, it's already having an impact. And I think one of the reasons for that is that FTX came after Luna. Maybe when things come out in the wash, we'll see that all of these things were indeed interconnected and knock-on effects of each other. But for a policymaker, you kind of see like a big incident happen, and then you see another big incident happen. And so every time these big incidents happen, or there's a crash, right, a bear market crash, there's this new kind of skepticism that emerges. Now, what I do think is a positive outcome from this is we've seen in policymakers take a victory lap and say, well, we thought that this was problematic and we've put in place a really robust regulatory framework and FTX wouldn't have happened on our watch. Whether that's true or not, I think what it does is signal to other policymakers that we do need to take action and that does need to be practical, supervisable, implementable, right? It needs to be tangible in its approach. However, I think for development of new use cases and the practical evaluation of the opportunities of DeFi or maybe the opportunities that might be presented with different types of NFTs, so like earlier, I mentioned mortgages or potentially royalties for television shows or movies, some of these emerging areas where NFTs might be able to replace different types of traditional assets. I think that slows all those conversations right down. And so we're looking at these really tangible, practical ways of protecting consumers. And ultimately, that is a regulator's job to protect consumers and to ensure that markets are fair. And I think that's one of the big takeaways that policymakers are trying to digest at the moment is, well, this marketplace obviously was treating customers really unfairly and wasn't an accurate representation of what this company was purporting to do. Now, as you say, one bad actor. But I think in this particular case, this actor was very involved in policy discussions. And so it's very understandable that policymakers who were maybe crypto curious have jumped back down off the fence and taken a more of a wait and see approach. And then I think, unfortunately, for those who were maybe a little bit deeper into the skeptic mindset, it is only reinforced for them. And so instigating those policy conversations, I think, will be hard for a while. And I think it is a real, it should be a signal to the industry that we absolutely have to be on our, not, I don't want to say our best behavior, but I used to, earlier in my career, I would say that crypto was in its infancy. And, you know, that's not true anymore. I mean, crypto has graduated into a toddler. And I would argue even now, I mean, we're knocking on the door of going to kindergarten, right? Like, and when you're 5 and 6 years old, you're expected to be able to still not bite and behave yourself for periods of time, unlike an infant that gets to just emote. And I think that if we put that into professional terms, the industry really needs to saddle up. And if that means we need to do better due diligence, if that needs less FOMO and really just place some scrutiny on ourselves, I think that's critically important now.
I think it's a really, it's a great way of framing it. We're at kindergarten stage now. And I think a lot of us in the industry are definitely looking at counterparty risk very clearly. And that I hope will help all of us to stand up a little bit taller. It's great to hear that, as you've outlined, the systemic risk that potentially stablecoins present is now being brought into the perimeter. So that's, I think, a very good step forward. And I think it's great to hear that the innovation's ahead of us, perhaps as we become teenagers, if not adults, as an industry. But I know we all look forward to constructive engagement with regulators and policymakers to make that possible. Dina, this has been most interesting as a discussion. Thank you so much for joining.
No, it was a real pleasure, Sean. Thanks for having me again.